In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we look back at several interviews with guests that all reference a type of silent invasion within the human race. The basic story structure is as follows. The invasion has been long complete. The anti-hero or protagonist, through some mishap, suddenly has the ability to see the monsters or aliens that have been walking among human beings for millennia. Stories such as Ray Nelson's 8 o'clock in the morning, Stephen King's The 10 O'Clock People, and Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas all reference an altering of human consciousness, either through drugs or hypnosis, that would allow the main character the ability to see through the invader's masquerade. Author and paranormal researcher John Keel believed some humans were actually androids, and in the Bible, the wheat and the tare parable tells of monsters disguised as humans existing among us. Movies such as They Live, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and the TV series V are constructed around a similar storyline. Are these authors, writers, and producers trying to communicate something beyond an entertaining science fiction story? As you will hear in these interviews, the line is blurred as to whether this invasion is science fiction or a reality hidden in plain sight. It is true that human eyes only detect light within a very narrow range within a broad electromagnetic spectrum, and that we have a physiological blind spot, the place in the visual field that corresponds to the lack of light-detecting photoreceptor cells on the optic disc of the retina, where the optic nerve passes through the optic disc. There are psychological blind spots and personality shadows that are also worth factoring in. What's interesting about the short story, 10 O'Clock People by Stephen King, is that the character's ability to see through the matrix is brought on by smoking cigarettes. Blazing up in the bank plaza and recognizing each other every day at the same time on their smoke breaks, hence the title. It does make you think about why cigarette smoking was banned in wide-open public spaces such as parks. There is talk of specific chemicals in cigarettes that help the brain quickly navigate around propaganda and direct lies, but good luck finding that research. Is there something Stephen King wanted to let readers know, or has he used a popular science fiction story structure to hang his characters? We go now to hear an excerpt of The 10 O'Clock People, a story by Stephen King on audiobook.
The 10 O'Clock People by Stephen King, read by Joe Morton. Pearson tried to scream, but shock robbed his voice and he was able to produce only a low, choked whuffling, the sound of a man moaning in his sleep. He drew in breath to try it again, but before he could get started, a hand seized his left arm just above the elbow in a strong pincer's grip and squeezed. It'd be a mistake. The voice that went with the hand said. It was pitched only half a step above a whisper, and it spoke directly into Pearson's left ear. A bad one, believe me, it would. Pearson looked around. The thing which had occasioned his desire, no, his need to scream, had disappeared inside the bank now, amazingly unchallenged. And Pearson found he could look around. He had been grabbed by a good-looking young black man in a cream-colored suit. Pearson didn't know him, but he recognized him. He sight-recognized most of the odd little sub-tribe he'd come to think of as the 10 o'clock people, as he supposed they recognized him. The good-looking young black man was watching him warily. "Did you see it?" Pearson asked. The words came out in a high-pitched, nagging whine that was totally unlike his usual confident speaking voice. Good-looking young black man had let go of Pearson's arm when he became reasonably convinced that Pearson wasn't going to shock the plaza in front of the First Mercantile Bank of Boston with a volley of wild screams. Pearson immediately reached out and gripped the young black man's wrist. It was as if he were not yet capable of living without the comfort of the other man's touch. The good-looking young black man made no effort to pull away. He only glanced down at Pearson's hand for a moment before looking back up into Pearson's face. "I mean, did you see it? Horrible! Even if it was makeup or some kind of mask someone put on for a joke!" but it hadn't been makeup, and it hadn't been a mask. The thing in the dark gray Andre Sears suit and $500 shoes had passed very close to Pearson, almost close enough to touch. God forbid, his mind interjected with a helpless cringe of revulsion, and he knew it hadn't been makeup or a mask. Because the flesh on the huge protuberance Pearson supposed was its head had been in motion, different parts moving in different directions like the bands of exotic gases surrounding some planetary giant. Friend, the good-looking young black man in the cream-colored suit began, you need... What was it? Pearson broke in. I never saw anything like that in my life. It was like something you'd see in a sideshow or... His voice was no longer coming from its usual place inside his head. It seemed to be drifting down from someplace above him instead, as if he'd fallen into a snare or a crack in the earth, and that high-pitched, nagging voice belonged to somebody else, somebody who was speaking down to him. Listen, my friend, there was something else, too. When Pearson had stepped out through the revolving doors just a few minutes ago with an unlit Marlboro between his fingers, the day had been overcast, threatening rain, in fact. Now everything was not just bright, but overbright. The red skirt on the pretty blonde standing beside the building 50 feet or so farther down, she was smoking a cigarette and reading a paperback, screamed into the day like a fire bell. The yellow of a passing delivery boy's shirt stung like the barb of a wasp. People's faces stood out like the faces in his daughter Jenny's beloved pop-up books. And his lips. He couldn't feel his lips. They had gone numb the way they sometimes did after a big shot of Novocaine. Pearson turned to the good-looking young man in the cream-colored suit and said, This is ridiculous, but I think I'm going to faint. No, you're not, the young man said, and he spoke with such assurance that Pearson believed him, at least temporarily. The hand gripped his arm above the elbow again, but much more gently this time. Come on over here, you need to sit down. That wasn't just a hallucination. Was it? He asked. What I saw, you saw too, right? Lineman nodded. You didn't want him to know I saw him, Pearson said. He spoke slowly, trying to put it together on his own. His voice was back in its usual spot again, and that alone was a big relief. Lineman nodded again. But how could I not see him, and how could he not know it? Did you see anyone else getting ready to hollow themselves into a stroke like you were? Reinman asked. See anybody else even looking the way you were? Me, for instance? Pearson shook his head slowly. He now felt more than just frightened. He felt totally lost. I got between you and him the best I could, and I don't think he saw you, but for a second or two there, it was close. You looked like a man who just saw a mouse crawl out of his meatloaf. You're in collateral loans, aren't you? Yes. Brandon Pearson, sorry. I'm in computer services myself, and it's okay. Seeing your first Batman can do that to you. Duke Reinman stuck out his hand, and Pearson shook it. But most of his mind was one turn back. Seeing your first Batman can do that to you, the young man had said.
The hideous monsters that only cigarette-smoking people can see, that are somehow disguised among regular people, are in positions of power and influence. In other words, the aliens with human holograms are running the show. The only people who can see them have altered their chemistry, being last holdouts with a cigarette habit. This next interview only aired on Dark Matter Radio and on YouTube. It's an interview that takes what you just heard as a fictional story by Stephen King and brings it into something that's very real for Richard Bruce. He's one of a select handful who have risen within YouTube's popularity, purporting to reveal humans shapeshifting into creatures with scales and claws and other types of anomalies. When you do the research, you'll find that there's a consensus that a liquid crystal hologram technology suit is worn by these beings, and it glitches out, causing digital artifacts. Additionally, you'll notice that the individuals shapeshifting are often news anchors, actors and actresses, or politicians, or military leaders. They're the people often in positions within society to influence public opinion, or to make legislation, or maybe reaffirm a false story. You've heard this before, you say. Well, let's hear part of this interview with Richard Bruce, who was at the time in his camper in Los Angeles.
when I first came across these reptilian shapeshifter movies, I thought that they were total baloney, total, you know, just people getting excited over codec errors, little blurs, little, you know, just any number of things, refresh rate problems. I mean, you know, but, or people having, like when I saw those slit eyes, I thought, oh, these are people having fun with After Effects, you know. I thought this was that's what they were doing, you know. But the more I saw them, the more I realized that there was something to this. And I started, you know, just kind of looking at more of them. And then I saw on the news some guy just right in front of my face with, I mean, really clear vertical black slit pupils that were like big. I mean, these are right in front of my face. And I wouldn't have even realized this looking right at it if I hadn't been aware of this whole reptilian shapeshifter subject after watching some of these movies on YouTube. So when I saw this, I whipped out my video camera and just shot my TV. Just my simple consumer-grade video camera. I have a little Samsung, and I just whipped it out and shot my TV and just, you know, held it as steady as I could and just, you know, focused in on it and zoomed in and zoomed out. And then I took the footage apart in my video editor. And that's the first time, Jeff, that I realized that this is real. I mean, this is not BS. I saw things that I knew, knowing something about digital video and digital images, that, you know, whatever this was, it was not a camera glitch, because both the male and a female also that was on that show on KCET were showing things that you could absolutely positively not have a camera error cause. And when I saw that feature, you know, with no reflection in the pupil, and it's going all the way up and down from the top of the iris to the bottom of the iris, that's how I knew it was, there was something more to this. And the more, it took a long time. This is what's really important about this. And, you know, if your listeners take anything away from this, it takes time. It took me months to even believe something like this could be going on. And so when you can't believe it, then you can't realize it in your mind. And that's one of the things that I think is important about uploading this footage and uploading credible, clear, rational footage, not a bunch of loud psychedelic music and flashing back and forth and so forth. You know, show the effect as clearly as you can. One of the problems is that the shape-shifting often shows up in a smaller or far away shot when there's distance between the subject and the camera lens. Yeah, this is an important point to make. I've got some of the best shape-shifting footage from a situation where there's distance from the camera to the subject. In fact, I got the Obama clear hand footage on a far shot of Obama from the podium, and this is historic footage. Okay, I challenged anyone. I wasn't even looking for anything on Obama. I was looking for more stuff on KCET for my very first upload, which I uploaded on January 9th, 2013. That was my very first shape-shifting movie that I uploaded. And so when I saw this on KCET, I thought, well, I'll look for more shapeshifters on KCET. But when I did, I caught a piece of Obama on the State of the Union on the John McLaughlin show. And when I saw this, I saw Obama in the background, and I noticed his hand was clear. So I you know, reanalyzed the footage and took it into the video editor, and then I made that movie, Obama Clear Hand. And actually, one reason it went viral is because somebody copied it and added some music, because back then I didn't even add any sound to my movies. And I got like 300,000 views, like really fast, and at somebody else's channel. And I wasn't worried about anybody stealing from me, you know, because I figure, hey, my main point is to get the word out. Because the main thing I realized about this, Jeff, is that we're getting used, and we're getting lied to in a big way. And yeah, I mean, as in human beings, as opposed to extraterrestrials with features like claws and fangs and standing from 7 to 9 feet tall and weighing 400 to 600 pounds, and they, and you know, this is, I mean, it's beyond comprehension. That's one thing that's really important about this, is because they've got us so duped and so hypnotized with this society, and so in a mindset of just scrubbing along just to survive. I mean, I think David Icke in his earlier work does a great job of describing how they make us little scurrying animals. You're too busy surviving to really stop and contemplate some of the deeper issues about what's happening behind society. There's no time to do anything. You know, it boggles the mind why no one does anything about this, but, you know, what's happening is it's mind control. That's what it is. It's thought control. They've got us in a situation where, you know, it is difficult to believe in the very elements. It's not just your mind not able to believe it. It's that your emotions are set against it. Because I noticed how people get mad when you start to talk about the truth. You know, I said, you know, four LAPD came to my door as a result of uploading Shapeshifter movies. Yeah, sure, I was just going to say, watch my movie, The Source of Vampires, because I think that transparency is what people have been recording in these vampire movies, where they see the person transparent in the mirror. I happen to think, from a conversation I just recently had with somebody, that it's actually not a hologram. It's a cross-dimensional issue. They're hybrids. They're half in one dimension, half in ours, which is why when there's distance from the camera, the time that it takes the light to hit the lens causes an anomaly wherein the being starts to actually disappear, and that's the partial transparency or full transparency. Now, as for the interference, I'll tell you exactly what happened, and let me be real clear about this, because first of all, when somebody says something like I'm going to say, there's a big credibility gap. So I want to make clear, my name is Richard Bruce, I'm a resident of Los Angeles, and I have no priors. I am not a criminal, I have no criminal history, I am not involved with criminal elements, and I never have been. I've led a pretty simple life, for the most part, until now. When I uploaded my first reptilian shapeshifter movie on January 9th, 2013, I didn't get a response. But then, 2 weeks later, when I uploaded my first full report on the movie The Matrix, which I entitled that movie Reptilian Matrix Message, immediately, this is what's hard to believe, immediately, I mean, we're talking within the hour, I think it was like 15 minutes, my house, my apartment in Woodland Hills, California, was surrounded by helicopters. And at the time, it was so, I just thought that they were busting somebody in my building. I thought they were, you know, it was a police chase or some news or something big happening in my building. I didn't even realize that it was an immediate reaction to what I was doing. And so he said, well, how did you know that was what, you know, a reaction to what you were doing? Well, what happened was that right after that, on a continual basis, on a daily basis, helicopters would buzz my house. And by buzz, I mean you hear it at a distance. It starts out low. And I've never experienced hearing helicopters like this before in my life, and I've lived in Los Angeles all my life, and I'm 44. And I heard this distance, noise in the distance. You hear going, and it gets louder and louder. And the whole building shakes, and it flies over. And at first, when it first started happening, I mean, it was intimidating. You know, I was intimidated. I mean, I realized that there was something going on, and right away I thought, you know, what the hell is going on? And then I thought about it. My God, it's these movies I'm uploading to YouTube. Holy cow! I mean, get it. On no uncertain terms was this a message. Stop what you're doing. I mean, that was the clear message. Now, you know, as you know, I didn't stop.
Richard Bruce had received a lot of attention last year when he uploaded a video titled Obama Clear Hand, State of the Union, 2013. The video shows the president's hand becoming transparent while he's delivering the State of the Union. The video had 300,000 views very quickly, and Richard's life was never the same. He's currently homeless and experiencing classic harassment and gang-stalking techniques. Richard continues to upload shape-shifting reptilian videos. He's revealed more bizarre anomalies, and the harassment constantly occurs. You may recall an interview with Carissa Conti, who wrote Chasing Phantoms, Personal Experiences, Observations, and Theories into the Abduction Mind Control Phenomenon, where she described her experiences of being harassed, abducted, and interfered with. We've also talked about how wireless RF microwave radiation interferes with human brain frequency, and how a highly organized apparatus is set up around us to monitor the etheric or psychic realm. Los Angeles was also the setting for the 1988 paranoid cult classic film They Live, directed by John Carpenter. It's about a homeless drifter who stumbles upon the reason for the massive economic disparities among the rich and poor. He sees it's because society has been infiltrated by non-human beings who have disguised their grotesque features so they appear human and blend in undetected. The hero of this cult classic has found an underground group preparing to stop the invasion. The group has made special sunglasses so you can see the monsters among the regular humans. The sunglasses also revealed subliminal messages on all signage, sinking the human mind into a trance of consumption. They Live was based upon the short story 8 O'Clock in the Morning, published in November 1963 by Ray Nelson. Ray worked with John Carpenter to rewrite the story for film. Ray was a guest on In Other News, and we spoke about his short story, 8 O'Clock in the Morning, and the film They Live. We hear now an excerpt from that interview.
Well, the basic plot is that the world is being run by space monsters, but nobody knows because they're hypnotized. But one guy wakes up, and he starts battling against the overwhelming odds of the space monsters. And even though he is killed in the struggle, he manages to broadcast a wake-up call to the human race about the space monsters.
Would you say that you were also politically influenced, spending time with other writers in Paris?
Yes, I definitely would. They cured me of my fear of socialism, because they were democratic socialists, but that was not the same thing as being a communist, which seemed to have been the attitude of people in the USA. And so I would say probably I could be now classified as a democratic socialist. And there's a sneaky democratic socialist theme creeping under 8 o'clock in the morning, because 8 o'clock in the morning is sort of a metaphor for what we now call the 1% that are the ruling class of this planet.
This is very interesting, Ray. This is a very interesting element here. That's something I didn't really notice. But you were mentioning that these monsters at the time, as a joke, were considered, oh, these are the Republicans.
No, I don't think very many people caught on. But unfortunately, the backers who were Republicans, they caught on. And they canceled two sequels that were already scheduled and had even been slightly shot. The special effects for They Live 2 were used in the promotion of They Live 1. But no more money. And the guy who was pushing the cart onto the lot selling snacks, he and John Carpenter were not allowed to be on the set for years. And John Carpenter, when he finally got back on, always had a so-called secretary following him around, making sure he was a good boy.
I always wondered if there was going to be a They Live 2 or it was even considered. And I even, in the end of They Live, that hypnotic beam on the top of the TV station was blown up. Mm-hmm. And so the spell was broken. Everybody could see what these creatures were and what was in their landscape. And then I was thinking, well, they contain the disaster in some way, rebuild another device to restructure the hypnotic trance, revise history as if this never happened, and it's 50 years later, and you have remnants of a revolution in the past, but no one's quite sure what really happened.
Well, that's one possibility, but the possibility that I wrote was that someone from our planet goes to their planet and stirs up the fires of rebellion on the home planet of the space monsters. John Carpenter thought it was fine, and a lot of people who had worked on this show thought it was fine, but unfortunately, John, in an interview for, I guess it was a fan magazine for science fiction films, he let slip that part about it being a satire on the Republicans, and the Republicans heard the broadcast. And were they unhappy? They thought this was just a cheap, money-making monster film, and here we had subversively snuck in a political message.
You could substitute Republican for a lot of different things, so to take it so personally was quite revealing.
I guess so, but one thing that happened in my movie, and that is there was an Occupy movement, and now there is an Occupy movement. A lot of the action took place in an Occupy movement camp. That's where the space monsters, proxies in the form of the police department, smash up all the improvised dwellings of the occupiers.
When they were destroying the Occupy camps here in New York, mm-hmm. There were scenes right from that, like the bulldozing down of the tents. You actually mm-hmm. saw that in Philadelphia, New York. So you were probably thinking this aspect has materialized in the real world.
Well, that's about what I thought. I was as surprised as anybody because I thought I was writing fiction. But science fiction has this weird ability to materialize in our own universe from time to time.
All right, so in They Live, you needed special sunglasses to see through the hologram disguise of the aliens among us.
That's right.
But George Nada, the character in 8 o'clock in the morning, woke up from hypnosis during a show, some entertainment he was watching, but he woke up out of a deeper trance.
Yeah.
What does that symbolize? Because you wake up, everybody else wakes up, and they're back in reality, but something else happened to this character.
Well, what I intended to happen in the original story was that he was just a little bit farther from being hypnotized than the rest of the people in the audience, so he could see through the hypnotic suggestion. And that didn't photograph well. We needed something that people could see on the screen other than just somebody changing his mind. And there was a tourist gadget at Venice, you know, a part of Los Angeles. It looks like a Venetian blind, only it's sunglasses. We first thought we would use that, but then John thought it was too close to something that everybody knew about, so we switched over to sunglasses with special properties. But we needed something that we could photograph, and that turned out to be the glasses. And we needed the source of the hypnosis to be visible and destroyable as an object, so we had that broadcasting device that was broadcasting the spell all over the world. There's no change in the basic idea, but there is an adaptation to the needs of the screen.
It must have been really interesting to be on the set and work with John Carpenter on this idea. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about the dynamic of hypnosis in 8 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
You called the monsters Fascinators.
That's it.
Why that name?
Well, because the essence of hypnosis is to fascinate somebody, to grab their attention so that they don't actually see anything outside of what you want them to see. And the first title of the story was actually The Fascinator, but the editor thought that was too pulpy, and so we switched to 8 o'clock in the morning.
It reminds me also of vampires and the glamour.
Mm-hmm. Yep, there's the connection there, all right.
All right, so you point out that the Fascinators, which are the disguised lizards, mm-hmm. needed to also be convinced of their hypnotic domination over humans for the mm-hmm. spell to work.
Ah, that is the clinical description of what happens in hypnosis. the guy who's doing the hypnotizing has to show absolutely no lack of confidence in the activity or it won't work. And that is something that I've seen, as I say, in my experiences with Scientology, that Scientology doesn't work unless the person who's administering it is confident that it will work.
So if you start to break the confidence of your oppressors, then you start to gain an advantage.
Yes, 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 especially if there are a whole lot of you and only a few of him. That's the case, as we see, with the one percenters.
Yes, it is. I noticed the idea of good lizards helping humanity is used in V, for example. Is that something you considered for They Live?
That's what happens in the thus far unfilmed second version of the story. It was supposed to be a trilogy, but it only managed to squirm its way to the screen once before people started to, or especially the Republicans who were putting the money behind it, discover what it really was. But as I say, we have another protagonist. He manages to go to the home planet, stir up a revolution among what we might call the good space monsters. So we were all set to do that particular variation, but we never got to do it.
Do you think now maybe John Carpenter or somebody else could put that sequel together?
I think it's harder now. I think we're being watched much more intently and with much more high tech than ever before in history. So you don't have to go very far off the beaten path before an alarm goes off somewhere. I imagine that somebody is listening to this telephone call and recording it. Wouldn't surprise me.
Has anyone approached you or approached John? I don't know who has the rights to this sequel. It's just sitting dormant? It seems like, why couldn't an independent filmmaker take this on?
Well, it's because the studio owns the copyright.
Okay, right. If somebody creates an alternative They Live, they'd have to call it something else, and a different storyline.
That's true. It'd have to be so much different, they might as well just start from scratch and make a new movie. One of the things that is hard to deal with, but it's one of the facts of life, is that all the movie studios are owned by multinational corporations that get to say no to any project. And so at this time, that wasn't the case when we made our film. Now the gates are a lot more locked.
Some researchers purport there will never be an authentic alien invasion because they're already here. If an overt alien invasion were to take place, it most likely will be a staged event. As you've heard, Ray Nelson placed emphasis on breaking the hypnotizer's confidence as a primary strategy to undermine the mind control spell, preventing humans from seeing the interloper's true form. The mind control system depicted in the film They Lived used television as the main vehicle to hypnotize the population. But you've heard this before. Watching TV has been described as dreaming with your eyes open. In this hypnotic state, the subconscious is wide open to suggestive images, complex symbols, harmonics, and according to past guests, Bonnie Jean Mitchell and John Mitchell, much more. They produced a very insightful video titled Global Epidemic Exposed Television Sigil Magic, and it describes how mnemonic circles and sigils are used in television graphics to put the viewer into a trance. From that point on, you're vulnerable to deep programming. Let's hear some of that interview with Bonnie and Jean Mitchell.
So on the TV, they also use imagery, and the imagery is full of symbols that the conscious mind does not recognize. Once again, is the subconscious that is targeted. And imagery can actually embed commands in your subconscious mind so that later, when you see something or hear something, it can trigger the command that's been put into your brain. Everybody's seen a hypnotist hypnotize someone and tell them, when you wake up, you're going to cluck like a chicken or something like that. And then when you wake up, you cluck like a chicken. It's just
especially at a command. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like programming a computer, basically.
Yeah.
And they also use harmonic frequencies on television to actually manipulate your neuron pathways. Now, harmonic frequencies can be used to heal. They can be used for good, but they're not used for good on TV. They're used to manipulate your neuron pathways and embed detailed commands. Once again, so they can trigger those commands later when you hear certain sounds or see certain images. They're basically telling us how to think, what to feel, how to act. If you're watching TV, you're getting programmed. And another thing that happens, and I've been hearing this term a lot lately in different interviews we've been watching, listening to, is cognitive dissociation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the brain naturally dissociates when it has something like a trauma or something overwhelming that it just can't handle. Mm-hmm. It kind of steps aside, you know, to protect itself. And this is what's happening on TV with the trauma-based mind control.
Right, and that's where what we're seeing is there's a reason why all of the sex and the violence is being ramped up and has been ramped up since day one. The first television came out in 1924, and ever since then in the movies and in television, actually when it hit the United States even harder was after the Nazis developed the TV further, and then it was introduced heavily in the 50s here in the States. But ever since then, they've been ramping this up, and what we're noticing is by studying trauma-based mind control, which, and I always mention Fritz Springmeier, he's definitely the best, in my humble opinion, the best author to look at towards an explanation of what trauma-based mind control is and what the Illuminati actually is. And what we're finding is that the more you study trauma-based mind control and what the Illuminati satanic families do to mind control their victims, including their own family members, it is paralleled with what we're seeing on TV. So essentially, in a nutshell, you turn the TV on, it puts you into an alpha or even deeper, like beta and delta.
Beta or delta. It gets deeper and deeper the more you watch
right.
the TV.
Right, which is also what the Illuminati trauma-based mind control does. First, they trance out normally the children because that's their victims normally. They trance them out, and then they abuse them and traumatize them. The TV trances you out, and then the program, okay, listen to the magical spells that we're talking about here, these magic words. The program then dissociates sex and violence in the viewer or slash victim watching the show, and they've ramped all of this up in their abilities to manipulate the mind, as Bonnie said, through the flicker rate, through the higher technologies. Bonnie has some more stuff she can talk about along that line, where there's actually technology out there where there it's not just about the program or the images that you're seeing. The machine itself, or the television, your Kindle, your iPad, your smartphone, basically anything with a screen on it, is now being used to pulse electromagnetic frequency and manipulate right down to your DNA, like Bonnie was saying. So.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It is incredible. But it's all researchable. It's all fact. It's all right there. All one has to have is love and care in their heart, which is what the Illuminati's ultimate goal is, to destroy that in human beings to make us like them. As long as you have this care and love in your heart, you're able to go on and research this stuff, and it's right there in the United States Patent Department for anybody to look this stuff up.
A past guest named Mark Passio, who you guys know, he pointed out in an interview a few weeks ago that I'm not sure if the powers that be, these Illuminati families, want us to be like them necessarily. He says they want us to be enslaved.
Mm-hmm. Right. But if you look at who these people are, who the Illuminati is, let's say the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the Queen of England, all the archbishops and the Pope and all these type of people who are, a lot of people say, you know, that they're schizophrenic or psychopathic. Sure, their actions are psychopathic, but this all goes down to demonic possession, in my opinion. But what I mean by just like them is they have not only do they not have care and love in their heart, they do not possess the human capacity for love and care in their heart anymore. And this is what they want to turn everybody else into, basically robots that will do their bidding. And that's not to say that they are also robots, but on some level, each one of them are being controlled. You know, even if you go to what's apparently the highest level, like let's say the president of the corporation known as the United States, Barry Satoro, who's also known as Barack Obama, he has handlers, okay? So, you know, all these people are just at the top of the pyramid. I personally believe that it's not human at the very top, and it's all a matter of control all the way down the pyramid, all the way to the base of the pyramid where you have your soul dyers, your soldiers, and your police, which are like very heavily affected trauma-based mind control victims with left brain damage. And that's also on Mark. Mark has been speaking on this, Mark Passio, for a long time about both left and right hemisphere brain damage and how it occurs and what it means to our society. Just to plug his website for sure is whatonearthishappening.com, and everybody should definitely study Mark Passio.
He really hit it out of the park weeks ago, and I got some great comments from listeners. Now, John, you've done some serious investigative work on mnemonic circles and sigils in regard to the images in television programming and also great video games and other visual entertainment. And as Bonnie has pointed out, things have ramped up a lot more. I know what you're talking about. I saw when they were coming into television graphics before the digital conversion. And I always thought that these were the interiors of a camera or the lens, and they were just taking it apart and, you know, geeking out in a way and in an illustrative way to show you what's inside a camera, the lens, and the working parts. But it's not necessarily that. Can you explain what's going on here?
Right. Well, with sigil magic, individual shapes actually speak through the eye to certain aspects of the subconscious. That's how sigil magic works. And it's been a long time now that magicians, especially these dark magicians, have figured out specific shapes that actually take charge of the subconscious mind and control it. Bonnie's going to be able to speak a lot more about that and how it relates to Solomon's Key. But just to put it in a nutshell, what a sigil is any shape or form that the magician makes himself and or herself, they give that sigil, that form, a particular meaning and intention and energy. And this could be a single sigil for a single magician, and they are the only ones who put this intention into it. They're the only ones who know what this sigil means, but it still gives it power. And I'll explain that in just a second, that it's scientifically proven that it has power. But then there's other sigils where you'll have a magician make the sigil and put it out into the public's eye, and everybody understands what that sigil means, and they all energize that sigil with their own intention and meaning. And a good explanation of that is if I tell everybody who's listening to this to just put their finger in the air and make a swoosh mark in the air, without saying another word about that swoosh mark, most of the people hearing my voice are going to think of Nike. And that's how powerful that is. And incidentally, that swoosh mark is actually a representation of the ring of Saturn, which is a whole other can of worms we probably won't have time for in this interview. But the Saturn death cult is what this all boils down to. So a sigil is basically a shape that has energy or intention. It means something, and it can mean that for a lot of people to all give it power or just on an individual basis. And our language and all languages are sigil magic. If you think about it, we're, as young children, we're all put in schools, these institutions, and we're taught to spell.
On the show, we've also talked with several guests about the quiet buildup of hundreds and thousands of microwave antenna towers, radar domes, and multiple ionospheric heater sites. This is in context of our environment being saturated with man-made electromagnetic and microwave radiation. We've also had many guests on to talk about how this wireless radiation is interfering with the human brain frequency, and it was pointed out again by frequent guest Dr. Carmen Bolter. The discussion, if you've caught the past shows, connect to the work of Wilhelm Reich and what's known as deadly orgone radiation, or DOR. DOR was explored in past shows with Don and Carol Croft, who run the site etherecwarriors.com, and past guest Dr. John Hall, who wrote the book A New Breed, Satellite Terrorism in America, went into detail about tracking individuals by satellite, real-time surveillance, and gang stalking. We go now to a short clip with past guest Dr. John Hall.
If you look back at Robert G. Malek, M-A-L-E-C-H, if you look back at his research from 1974, he had already developed an apparatus for monitoring brain waves remotely. And that's done by actually transmitting two separate carrier frequencies into the brain of a subject. When those two frequencies interact with the brain's own natural waveform, it creates a interference waveform that can be transmitted back to a receiver. That can be hooked to a computer, can be modified, transmitted back to the brain for what they call entrainment. Let's say if you have a dictionary, if you will, of different brain waveforms that cause different subjects to behave or feel different ways. Like, let's say you want to make someone agitated, and you have a certain brainwave pattern that you know causes agitation in most human beings. Well, you can receive that person's brainwave, alter it to be the agitated brainwave state, retransmit it back to the subject, and their brain will entrain it, and it will start producing a waveform similar to the one that's been retransmitted, and then you'll in turn cause that person to be agitated or cause that person to be sedate. At the time, that was invented as a monitoring technique for pilots. What they wanted to use it for were for military pilots. That way they could monitor their brain waves remotely and be able to detect when they hallucinate or when they get sleepy. And then they could conversely retransmit a altered brainwave back to the subject or the pilot to wake them up or to stop them from hallucinating if they've, you know, been flying for long periods of time or spending too many hours in the cockpit.
While the plane is flying, a satellite is doing this to the pilot's brain while they're flying?
Well, at the time it was invented, it wasn't available on satellite. This was being done with computers and ground-based technology, but this was in 1974. I would assume that it has probably been perfected and certainly appears to be on our satellite system now. As a matter of fact, about 2006, there were two CIA agents in Illinois who were arrested for trying to trade access to one of our biosensing satellite systems with some drug dealers for large quantities of drugs. And just last month, there was an employee of the CIA arrested in Massachusetts for trying to sell broad-spectrum frequency analyzers and other types of electronic equipment used for harassment to a private company in Massachusetts.
They're catching up with some of these people. And who is this person? Who would do something like this?
A lot of times, like I said, this is being done in an agency sterile fashion. So even though these people, there's been a couple of them that have been arrested, that doesn't mean that they weren't instructed to do it. Now, as you know, the CIA operates on plausible deniability. In my mind, I think that at least in the case in Illinois, they knew they were selling this to a group of criminals that would be using it to victimize people. I think it was part of the larger experiment that's underway right now. Now, the guy in Massachusetts, God, I'm trying to remember his name. It was just in the, as a matter of fact, it made the news. That may have actually been someone just trying to make a profit. He claimed that he had just gotten back from Iraq, that it was used equipment that he was using in Iraq, and tried to sell it to this Massachusetts company. The name of the company wasn't given, but they thought it was a little suspect when the equipment was still in the boxes and was apparently brand new. So they ran the serial numbers, tracked it back to the company that makes it, and the company that produces it said, no, this is proprietary CIA equipment. But the news story that covered it did state to the public that this equipment is used for electronic harassment. It's out there. There are people that have access to it that are selling it or giving it away to criminal groups.
In 2011, author Laura Nightyatchik was a guest on In Other News, and she talked about the book Political Ponderology, a Science on the Nature of Evil Adjusted for Political Purposes. There is a small minority of the human population unable to experience or comprehend the normal range of human emotions. They're called psychopaths. The study of psychopaths and their rise to power is researched in the book Political Ponderology by Andrew Lobachevsky. The original manuscript of this book went into the furnace minutes before a police raid in communist Poland. The second copy, painfully reassembled by scientists and sent to the Vatican, received no acknowledgement. The third and final copy was written from memory, its publication blocked by Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Let me give you a little example. Take the legal system. The legal system is set up so that basically it's kind of like a trial by ordeal. You know, in the old days they had the trial by ordeal. If you were telling, they touch your tongue with a hot poker, and supposedly, if you're lying, your tongue will be dry, and the poker will burn you. But if you're telling the truth, your tongue will be moist, and the poker won't burn you. Well, a normal person who feels fear, his mouth is going to go dry, right? Mm-hmm. And the poker is going to burn him. So the person who is feeling fear, not because he's a liar, but because he's normal, is going to be burned and be condemned. But a psychopath who feels no fear whatsoever can lie and touch his tongue to the hot poker, and it'll be moist and he won't get burned, and he gets away with it. Okay. In the legal system we have today, it's a little more advanced than this old trial by ordeal, but it's not that much different because you're getting tried in front of a jury of your peers, right? But these are people who do not know you. They do not know who's accusing you. They do not know the attorneys. You know, they know nothing except what's allowed to be presented in court. And then you take an oath, right? The oath acts on an honest person with a conscience. I am swearing to tell the truth. And, of course, if they tell a lie, you know, they look guilty, their eyes shift around, you know, they make these funny movements. All of these studies about, you know, how to tell when somebody's lying applies to a normal person who's trying to tell the truth or tell a lie. But it doesn't apply to a psychopath. A psychopath can get up there, swear an oath, and lie so convincingly that an innocent person is condemned.
This is really fascinating. It points out in the book Political Ponderology, our guest Laura Knight Yadchik had written the introduction for. It points out in the book that a psychopath in early childhood may look at someone crying as there's water coming out of their eyes. That's mm-hmm. interesting. And then learn to understand that these are emotions and then begin to mimic them. Yeah. And if they're very, very intelligent, they begin to mimic other emotions, but carefully craft the art of lying. However, do you often wonder about somebody that really lives on a bed of lies throughout their lives? How can they remember all of that?
Well, it's funny because psychopaths seem to have no problems. It's like their brains are like if-then constructions, but then if they get caught in a lie, they go along and continuously create their reality from one minute to the next. Hare gives the example of somebody who was caught in a bald-faced lie in the courtroom. They had a cast of his shoe print, you know, and an eyewitness, and he still insisted he was being railroaded and that they were all just attacking him for no good reason. In his reality, he had done nothing wrong. You know, he gives, if you've read Hare's book Without Conscience, he gives some really comical interviews with criminals, but you got to understand, Hare worked with criminals. Cleckley worked with a little bit more upper-class people who were not exactly criminal but got put into a hospital by their families because they were a big problem. Mm-hmm. The biggest problem are the psychopaths that we can only infer exist based on what little we can glean from those that come under our scrutiny in prisons or hospitals or, you know, quite by accident. And actually, there is one really good way to find out what goes on with psychopaths, and that is by talking to the victims. You know, for example, women who've been married to them. And Sandra Brown has got a book called Women Who Love Psychopaths.
Right, right.
She actually did a study, and she's a personal friend of mine, and we've worked together, and she's done some really marvelous work.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an actual study that was done with scientific methodology, evaluating what kind of women get taken in by psychopaths. And believe it or not, it's not weak women. It's strong women. Strong women who are determined, talented, they're usually very creative, and most of all, they're extremely empathic, because the empathic person is the primary victim of the psychopath, because one of their number one tools to use against a person is pity. You know, pity me, poor me, one way or the other. If somehow there's a hook. I'm just a good old boy, and I'm just trying to get by in this world and trying to help people out, and da-da-da-da-da, and boom, you're a goner.
Laura, you really hit something here, because I think it was in Harrison Keeley's work, he writes about they, meaning the psychopaths, see empathy, remorse, and a sense of responsibility, all the qualities usually considered as the epitome of goodness and humanity, as signs of weakness to be exploited.
Mm-hmm.
Laws and social rules as inconvenient restrictions on their freedom in any social behavior as deliberate nonconformity, a refusal to program by society's artificial standards. Love, guilt, and altruism strike the psychopath as comical and childish naivetes for bleeding hearts.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at how people have been rewarded for taking money and stealing money in the banking system, and they get massive promotions, the diagnosis of this condition of psychopathy begins to help make sense of these large-scale, inhumane decisions. And it puts a really important template over what's going on in the world today. And you mentioned that in your introduction. This is one of the most important books you can read, because I think it's because of this.
And here's the scary part. The scary part is that most people are still at the place that I was when I started out. They still think that these are normal people, and that if they talk enough, or if they explain enough, or if they produce enough evidence or enough, you know, convincing data, that some way, somehow, other people are going to believe things, or that this other person is going to change, or that somehow they were wounded in childhood and you just have to, you know, reach out to them, or they're just expressing their shadow side. It's not true. They are not normal in any way, shape, form, or fashion, and the real, true psychopaths are born that way.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.